big news from the Winnipeg Blue Bombers in recent days, and we discussed that today on Breakfast with the Bombers alongside Ed Tate from BlueBombers.com. The news that Andrew Harris will retire as a Blue Bomber, and he recently opened up on what happened when he left the team. A proposed seven-story mixed-use apartment building is in line for Sherbrooke, but a lot of people are against this and are speaking out against this proposal. So we were joined by Brent Bellamy, who is an urbanist, an architect, a columnist, and a big Winnipeg booster, to find out what's the problem. Camping reservations began today for Birds Hill, Winnipeg Beach, and Grand Beach. So with that in mind, we asked you to tell us your camping stories, good or bad. I'm Brett McGarry. Alongside Greg Mackling, we are Mackling and McGarry, and this is the Tuesday, April 9th podcast for The Start. Mackling and McGarry, many thanks to KK, the wonderful Kathy Kennedy, for filling in for me yesterday morning as I recovered from the insanity of WrestleMania 40.
Now, just to be clear, you were not participating. You were not in Philadelphia as an athlete.
No, I was not in Philadelphia as an athlete, not as a fan. Just got together with some pals on Sunday and watched that both the Saturday night, sort of skimmed through the Saturday night, and then we watched the Sunday event live. But good times were had. Got a decent sleep yesterday. So many thanks to KK for that. And I've been curious to ask you, G-Mac, how do you feel about the Winnipeg Jets heading into, because they did what they needed to do heading into this series of big games.
That's right. They've now won three games in a row. Decent performance on Saturday. Spoke to Jim Toth at 8:37 yesterday morning. I was otherwise occupied on Saturday afternoon, although a family birthday party be damned, we still had the Jets game on in the background. there was no way around it. We snuck a laptop into my sister's 40th birthday, and she expected that.
Yeah.
But I wasn't able to watch the game as much as I am used to. So I watched it yesterday afternoon instead.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, the Jets are not back, I wouldn't say, to where they were when they were playing their best hockey, but they're looking a little bit more like the Winnipeg Jets. And I like the way the different lines are playing, in particular that fourth line, the third line, really looking good. The Monahan Ehlers line sort of rounding into shape as well, playing with Kyle Connor. So it'll be interesting to see what they do in Nashville tonight. Nashville, I think, just 6 points back of the Jets, and a win for the Predators tonight. And they might get it in their head that they can still catch the Jets for third place in the Central. A win tonight for the Jets sets up an even bigger game for them against Colorado on Saturday, although they still have to play Dallas on Thursday. So it is a big week. And by winning the three games that they have leading into these next three games, it does give them an opportunity to be in control of their own destiny. First place in the Central, probably out of reach, but the idea of finishing second is very much alive.
All right, so we'll have the keys to the game with Cam Porteous coming up just after 8:10. Pre-game show tonight at 5 o'clock, puck drop at 7 on your radio home of the Winnipeg Jets, 680 CJOB. Also have some football to discuss this morning, G-Mac. It's Tuesday, which means Breakfast with the Bombers just after 7:30.
Yeah, we will have Ed Tate, BlueBombers.com. He's also a huge part of our game day coverage for the Blue Bombers. We call on him regularly, Ed and I co-host the halftime show on Blue Bomber Home broadcasts. And over the last week or so, the conversation, the excitement really around Andrew Harris signing a one-day contract. He'll do so later this month as part of a debut, the premiere of a documentary that's been made about him, the last several years of his life. That's something that a lot of Blue Bomber fans have been discussing and how excited they are, or, you know, it's about time. That's the way it ought to end. But I think lost in that headline is the fact that Andrew Harris was dealing with some pretty heavy stuff from the 2019 season on. And some people wondering, why did the relationship between the Blue Bombers and Andrew Harris disintegrate to the point where He didn't play his last two seasons in Winnipeg. Well, we've got some answers on the Handled Internally podcast hosted by Darren Cameron and Ed Tate. We'll play some of that audio for you at 7:35 and dig into it a little bit more with Ed when he joins us on Breakfast with the Bombers. It's some important stuff if you're a Blue Bomber fan and we're wondering what the heck happened with the Blue Bombers and Andrew Harris. Some answers for you.
All right. Looking forward to that just after 7:30. Breakfast with the Bombers every Tuesday just after 7:30. Also, curious to know, did you have a peek yesterday?
Nope. Behave myself.
Didn't look at the eclipse.
No, it's tough to look at the eclipse when you're looking at the inside of your eyelids.
You were asleep. You slept through it.
Slept through it.
Yeah, I guess it started, what, just before 1 o'clock and it went into 2 o'clock hour or so. I could
you,
not resist.
You couldn't resist.
No.
You trumped it.
I was, well, because it was cloudy. So I poked my head outside my balcony. I tried. I know I've got a pair of the special glasses gifted to us by Scott Young, astronomer at the Manitoba Museum. And I've got them somewhere in my home, couldn't find them. So I just poked my head out. I put on two pairs of sunglasses and took a look to see if there was anything through the clouds, if it was punching through. And I don't know if it was just that bright that it was able to punch through or if the clouds just weren't quite that thick, but I was able to I took a quick peek at it, and then I essentially watched or looked at it through the lens of my phone camera, and I got what I was actually pretty happy with the way the picture turned out. And yeah, if you want to see that on Instagram at Brett McGarry, but yeah, I looked, and it's funny because my eyeball hurts today. And I hope it's not connected. I'm pretty sure the pain that pain is a strong word, but I'm feeling just a slight pressure almost from behind my eyeball, my left eye. But I think that started before the eclipse, but the timing has me concerned.
I have no problem pretending to be lots of things. An optometrist or an ophthalmologist is not one of them, Brett. You're on your own on this one, buddy.
But right now, let's talk more about the eclipse. The total solar eclipse mesmerized millions of people in Canada, millions in the United States, giving them the chance to see the moon completely obscure the sun, which briefly plunged the day into darkness.
Global's Jeff Semple reports from Niagara Falls, Ontario, which was the eclipse's path of, indirectly in the eclipse's path of totality, and speaks with enthusiasts about what they thought of the rare celestial event.
Daybreak over Niagara Falls, Canada's most popular tourist destination. But on this day, the sun was the star attraction.
We are very excited.
This family from Toronto arrived at dawn to claim a front row seat.
I came here because it's not only my first time, I'm sure it's going to be so cool.
This group from Algonquin Territory in northern Quebec drove more than 10 hours for a special ceremony.
Women are protectors of the waters. It's about giving birth and protecting the water.
Millions across eastern Canada stepped outside hoping to catch a glimpse of the rare celestial event. And of all the places along its path, Niagara Falls was billed as the biggest, with up to 1 million visitors, prompting the region to preemptively declare a state of emergency, which may have backfired.
And unfortunately, when the region declared a state of emergency, a lot of people canceled their plans.
Still, hundreds of thousands turned out. Niagara Falls set a new Guinness World Record for the most people dressed as the sun. The only thing the city didn't have was good weather.
It's up to Mother Nature. Now all we need her to do is move some of her clouds out of the way.
This Ontario university is home to a century-old observatory and miniature model.
Here's the moon, which is orbiting the Earth.
This astronomer says the actual shadow is only about 180 kilometers wide, making it incredibly rare for so many Canadians to find themselves on the path of totality.
This literally is a once-in-a-lifetime experience for us to see an event like this.
All right, that was it. The moment of total eclipse here in Niagara Falls suddenly felt like somebody turned out the lights. The temperature has really dropped by more than 10 degrees. It was looking like a lunar letdown, too much cloud cover to see anything. But there it is, making a brief appearance through the clouds, a total eclipse. here in Niagara Falls, just in time. What did you think?
I think it was incredible.
Among those experiencing their first total eclipse, the man who's about to become the only Canadian to fly to the moon.
I am quite enamored with the moon lately.
Astronaut Jeremy Hansen enjoyed the view from Niagara Falls, USA, where NASA studied the atmosphere.
This provides a better opportunity to gather some specific data about the sun, which really matters to us.
Millions of Canadians united in awe and childlike excitement. And people in northwestern Canada will have their turn during our next total eclipse in 2044. Jeff Semple, Global News, Niagara Falls.
World record for people dressed as the sun. That caught me by surprise, Brett. You did not warn me about that part of the report.
I didn't catch it the first time. That's great.
That is. That's, you know, it's neat to see people so captivated by something like this. Mentioned it several times. I remember 1979 and being in grade four when this happened, when we were in the path of totality. But also Dallas, Texas was in the path of totality this time around. Mazatlan, Mexico. I saw people there that were celebrating. Kathy mentioned yesterday they were planning to celebrate in style with margaritas and just have an old fashioned Mexican party. And
nice,
sound good. At least a tourist type Mexican party, right? Because what Mexicans did versus the tourists, probably two different things. But fascinating stuff. And we were talking off the air about, can you imagine like 10,000, 20,000, 40,000 years ago when this happened for the first time or the only time? The panic, for people that, prehistoric people would have had no idea what was going on. Their reactions to it would have been horrifying, potentially.
Yeah, they probably figured that they'd done something to anger their god.
No question.
That would have been just scary, scary stuff. But for us, it just the childlike wonder. I was flipping through channels yesterday, and they had NBC was in Maine, and ABC was covering it, CNN was covering it, and even the hosts, I believe it was the hosts on NBC, the guy was getting emotional as the totality moment occurred, because probably for him it's a once in a lifetime shot and to get to see it. We got, I think, about 60% totality here. So I was checking in on the Manitoba Museum feed on, they were broadcasting, they were streaming on YouTube and Facebook. So I had a peek at that. Scott Young doing a great job hosting that. And they were going to different feeds from across the continent, but pretty cool for those who got the totality, and even for those here. Like I said, I was able to take a peek. I got what I think is a pretty nifty picture, and you can see that at my Instagram at Brett McGarry. Nothing special, but just a cell phone.
Well, I think it's a terrific picture that captures exactly what we saw in Winnipeg. And we know that Scott Young, 1979, that total eclipse, that dictated his path in life. That was the day he decided he wanted to become an astronomer. And so here we are.
You can read all kinds of coverage on this. In Manitoba, Global's Catherine Dornian did a great piece on what went down here. Eric Sorensen, he went on an expedition. He became an eclipse chaser, road tripping through eastern Ontario to experience the event. So lots of coverage.
That's a fun report.
Yeah, lots of coverage at cjob.com and globalnews.ca. So camping reservations start at 7 for Birds Hill, Winnipeg Beach, and Grand Beach. Yesterday was cabins, yurts, and group use areas. White Shell opens tomorrow. Spots in northern or western regions will start booking as of Thursday, and then any remaining campgrounds on Friday at manitobaparks.com. You can also do it over the phone. So in honor of this camping palooza that is about to begin, because like you pointed out, Greg, if you're a camping enthusiast, this is not something you can procrastinate on when it comes to planning.
No, you need to be on top of it. If you want to be camping on certain weekends and certain weeks in the summer, you need to book your site. And it's amazing how many people know the campgrounds inside out and exactly what spot, what specific campsite they want. And so everybody who's getting ready to do that, I wish you good luck. because it's such a great part. It's one of the special things about living in this part of the world is that we get to do that. And you can actually go camp, park your trailer somewhere. And even if mom or dad have to go to work for the week or part of it, you can commute back and forth. Oh, yeah. You know, my dad used to do that once in a while. Or, you know, he would take us out on Monday and he'd come out on Friday after work or whatever. There's just lots of ways that you can do it.
So at 204-780-6868 for a chance to win either tickets for dinner and a movie at the Met, Titanic, on April 14th, or tickets for Lighthouse, Club Region Event Center, on August 14th. By the way, there is a pre-sale for Lighthouse tomorrow at 10 a.m. The password is Sunny. And then tickets go on sale on Thursday. This is via Ticketmaster. So tell us your story about camping, be it good or bad, for a chance to win those tickets. And the winner will pick. Runner-up will get the other prize. And Sarah McCarthy, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Well, first of all, I was trying to think, have I ever truly, like, tented it? And I don't think so. It's always been, like, in a trailer, like an RV or a trailer. And even that, there's a lot of work that goes into it that
you're a glamper. You're not a camper.
I know. I mean, come on. That's what I said to Cam when we got this question. I'm like, do I look like I go camping? I don't think so. And I don't. We only did it, like, when I was, like, a young kid. So, like, you don't even notice how much work all of this goes into or appreciative of it. But I don't know. I just remember having a good time with my butterfly catcher and clearing up seashells from the shore. But this one time, it was in Blue Lake Provincial Park, I want to say, in Ontario, in Vermilion Bay. And they had this, like, swing set and different, like, equipment you could use in one of the group use areas. But they had these seesaws that were, like, pretty old and, like, wooden, and got, like, slivers all in my hands.
Oh, no!
Like, to the point where it was an infection. Like, so we had to go back to town to get antibiotics and get them, like, treated and pulled out. God. So that took a turn for the worse, but it's still a good memory overall.
How many slivers did they have to yank out of your hand?
At least 5 in one hand. Oh, yeah. And slivers are never fun, you know? It's one of those little things.
Was it a series of slivers, or was it one just fateful hand swipe that picked up all 5 in one go?
I want to say it was a couple. But, okay, like, you don't want to disappoint the other person on the seesaw and just end it.
Sam McCarthy, people pleaser.
Yeah.
Yep. Looks like a nice spot, though. I'm just looking at some Blue Lake Provincial Park. Yeah. Okay. Cam Poitras, what about you?
Well, my earliest memory of camping, my dad had got a trailer from somebody. I don't know who, but I know that he put a lot of work into it. It was a long weekend. Oh, goodness. I must have been 7 or 8. Not very old. And we got in our little camper and we drove out to a specific, very close to the city camping, popular camping spot. I'm not going to name the place. But we rolled into our spot, and it was the worst bay or whatever they call them spot in the entire park. It had to have been. It looked like somebody went and rototillered the entire ground of this one spot. It was only mud. It didn't stop raining for 2 days. And I remember I was miserable. My brother was miserable. My other brother was miserable. My mom was miserable. My dad, trying to make the best of a situation, obviously, that he planned a lot of, bought all the food, taking care of all the other stuff. He was trying to make the best of it, but he was not going to be the panacea to the everyone else's misery. And I remember we left after the first night and we went back home, but it was awful. We couldn't even, there was no fireplace. There was no fire area. It was just awful. It was so, so bad. And that sort of set the stage for my love of camping.
Fortune, what about you?
Oh, I don't know what story to say. There's so many, like, and none of them end good, you know? Like, when I was a kid, I remember going camping. I think it was with, like, beavers, cubs, or scouts, or whatever it was. And remember, it was just tick infested. Mm. Like, you would find ticks all over you. And I remember getting home and doing the old tick check. and finding one in the down below area. And, I was freaking out, man. I was freaking out. So I'm telling you, those are not good. Or there's the one time where my buddy, never trust your friend who says, like, oh, yeah, I got the tent. I'll bring the tent. Yeah, he brought the tent. He didn't bring the fly, like the cover for the top of the tent. First night wasn't bad, you know, able to sleep underneath the stars. But the second night, it started raining. So we're throwing our blankets and everything into our cars. And I had to sleep in my car. And I'm telling you, when I woke up the next morning, that was a dumb idea because it was so hot. Mm-hmm. I had heat stroke. And I remember coming to work 2 days later and Toth, he's just like, man, you must have had one hell of a weekend. I'm like, yeah, no, I've been in bed for the last 2 days because I've been like dead. I had heat stroke. It was terrible.
All right. Very well prepared.
Sorry to hear that, Forte. Yeah, the car sleep. I've only done that once at the cabin. Buddy had a cabin in Winnipeg Beach, and I couldn't get comfortable inside, and so I just went and slept in my car, and that was 10 times worse, and I woke up so sweaty and gross. Ugh, never again.
It's so bad.
And
it is so bad, the car sleep.
Mackley, what about you?
Couple of car sleeps. Once we got a campsite halfway between Banff and Jasper on the Icefields Parkway, and it was right next to the where you cook your supper. Well, bears apparently like to hang out there. So bears forced us to sleep as a family in our car. And then I once forgot also a tent altogether, Jeff, and had to sleep in the back seat of my buddy's Volkswagen Rabbit. That was not good.
Yeah, mine was a Chevy. The heck was my old car? It was a two-door car, Chevy. What can I remember? It was tiny. It was tiny back
tiny.
Then.
Tiny. It was no Cobalt, room. Wasn't it?
Cobalt, thank you. Brett actually remembers my first car, and I don't.
You clearly didn't care for it all that much if you've already suppressed it. It is Mackling and McGarry. Camping reservations have begun for Birds Hill, Winnipeg Beach, and Grand Beach. If you're into the system today, feel free to let us know how you do. You get what you want? In the meantime, Greg, it's Tuesday. What does that mean for 7:35?
Breakfast with the Bombers. Ed Tate will join us, bluebombers.com. All things Blue Bombers. We're going to focus on Andrew Harris. The big news last week was the fact that Harris is going to sign a one-day contract to retire as a member of the Blue Bombers. I know a lot of people have questions about what happened with the Bombers and Andrew Harris. We have some answers for you coming up after 7:35.
The challenge of getting to school. Many of you are encountering it right now, getting your children up, fed, and out the door in an hour or so.
Yeah, we have seen throughout the city the struggle to deal with absenteeism. Our 680 CJB colleague Richard Cloutier joins us now. And Richard, this is not exclusive to one area of the city, however.
No, it's not. And in a post-pandemic world, we have seen the value of school or how some students and parents have felt that, you know what, you're not feeling so well, don't go to school. We used to grin and bear it all the time, like going to work as well. So there's that type of absenteeism, but there's also the chronic absenteeism. And at Winnipeg School Division, and I'll tell you the story of one school. I spent some time at Isaac Newton School. It's a junior high. And the one term you think junior high versus middle school years. You think, oh, well, that's the same. I quickly discovered that it is not. At Isaac Newton School, until this past Monday, April 1st, they had been on kind of a junior high schedule where students move class to class to class. So they'd be moving three times in the morning, three times in the afternoon, grade 7, 8, and 9. It was disruptive. And very much like the three of us, right now, we're asking you to spend time with us. And it's all about engagement. The rule of radio is, what's the rule of radio, guys? Never be boring, right? Never be boring.
No dead air.
No dead air. And in this case, what was happening was that the kids were moving to classrooms all the time. And in between the classes, like the bell would go and they'd have to be at the next class somewhere else in the building like that. And what would happen? The cell phones would come out. There would be bullying going on. They'd talk to each other. And in some cases, they'd end up skipping class. So introduce the new superintendent, a guy by the name of Matt Henderson, who, and I'll tell you the book in a moment, but decides, you know what? We got to shake things around. And it's based on a philosophy that has been successfully employed south of the border in Chicago. But what they simply did was talk and talk and talk about shifting the schedule. And they decided, rather than wait till this September, they did it April 1st. So now, instead of having six or seven teachers a day, you have one or two. You're staying in the class, and suddenly there's engagement. One or two teachers. And the students, they like it, especially young ones like Nicholas Favel. He's 13 in grade 8. He's a bit of a larger kid, and he describes the before and the after.
I definitely did notice a big change in the whole week. Because back... Sorry.
That's okay. Take your time. What was the before like?
The before was like there was tons of... There was a little bit of chaos here in the hallways a lot. But now, ever since this whole change, there's barely any chaos. There's no kids skipping.
Nicholas, what was it like for you? Were you afraid of being bullied?
Yes, a lot.
What happened?
Well... Well, when there was this one time I remember, I was in the middle of switching classes, right? I seen this huge fight, right? It was between like half, nearly like three or so kids, and I went to go try and help break it up, but I couldn't. Then after that, I started to notice those kids kept trying to come, those kids were bothering me more and more often, they were trying to pick fights with me. So then I had to go to the office and tell them about it.
And now, you're in a classroom, there's not as much movement between classes, and does that make you feel safer?
A lot.
That's huge, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So how do you feel about coming to school now?
I feel way better, honestly, than before.
Feels way better about coming to school. And I think there's a lot of you listening right now that can identify with Nicholas's story. So Henderson, the superintendent, he decides early on in his tenure, when it comes to some of these vulnerable schools, we have to have the best teachers and the best vice principals and the best principals ever. So there was a shift that was going on and continues to go on. So there's a new principal at this school, one that worked with the existing staff and in conjunction with Henderson decided to make this move. But this entire approach is based on a book, and here's your homework, folks, The Make or Break Year, Solving the Dropout Crisis One Ninth Grader at a Time. And it's based on a simple idea, reorganizing schools to get students through the treacherous transitions of freshman year greatly increases the odds of those students graduating. And so for the grade sevens and eights at this class, they are connecting with teachers. They're going out into the community. They feel a whole lot more secure. There's less cell phone time. It's a pretty simple thing to do, right? But already a week in, it's starting to pay off with a lot of these kids. The teachers love it, and the community likes it too.
Those transition years are critical because the amount of responsibility that you have for your own education, it ramps up. Every time you go from these different areas, from junior high to high school to post-secondary. And so the idea of having a little bit more help through those transitions is critical.
Tamara Stevenson is the principal. 23 years as an educator. She started as an EA and worked her way through the system.
Like they were the conversations every time we had a conversation. And I think at first they were like, but we're junior high, but their belief system was very much a middle years model belief system. And so the schedule was something that was holding them back. And so once we worked through those tweaks with their input and just asking their questions, they came up with a big part of the plan. And then we decided, you know, we can make this work. We'll do what we have to do to make this work.
So look for these types of changes at other schools. And we'll tell you more about this story and dealing with these issues throughout the day here on 680 CJOB.
Richard Cloutier, co-host of the news, weekdays 3 to 6 on 680 CJOB. Today it's 3 to 5. Jets pregame show
what?
Starts at 5. That's right.
Yes. Short day.
Some ice hockey this afternoon, Mr. Kluche, ahead of the 7 o'clock puck drop against Nashville. Breakfast with the Bombers time, brought to you by Cooperators, investing in your future together. Now, late last week, Winnipeg Blue Bomber fans got a bit of a preseason surprise.
I'm really excited to be retiring as a Winnipeg Blue Bomber, officially. Just talking with you guys and going through this process. You know, being a Winnipeg born kid and watching the Bombers grow up, you know, I lived out a childhood dream, you know, playing for them and playing for you guys and in front of my friends and family. And you know, ending that 29-year drought was a highlight of my career. And in the film, you'll kind of see, you know, that was the ultimate kind of goal for me career-wise. And, you know, going through the transition of going to Toronto and everything, and now just being like, hey, like that was the highlight of my career. You know, those 5 years I played with the Bombers was really something special.
That announcement, part of a conversation which took place on the Blue Bomber Handled Internally podcast with Darren Cameron and our next guest. We welcome back to Breakfast with the Bombers, Ed Tate. Good morning, Ed.
Morning, fellas. How are you?
We're doing really well. You know, golf season upon us, football season not too far away. I'm hankering for both those things. As it pertains to Andrew Harris, I'm guessing you knew that this was going to happen, this one-day contract and Andrew retiring a Blue Bomber. What do you think it means for Andrew? And what do you think, maybe in my mind, more importantly, it means for Blue Bomber fans that 33 will be retiring as a Blue Bomber?
Well, I think you heard the clip there, in the clip there, that Andrew is very comfortable with the decision. I think it gives him some closure on how it ended here, because as everybody remembers, it did not end necessarily very well, kind of an ugly divorce when he felt he had been kind of left out to dry in negotiations with the club. And at the same time, Toronto called him in free agency, and so he left. I think there was a lot of bitterness there, but as he said in the podcast, I think he understands now, given a little bit of time, that why the club made the decision to move on or lowball him on an offer, because his role was going to change. And I think for Bomber fans, you know, seeing him in Toronto colors was, you know, made some people squirm a little bit, right? It just didn't look right to see a guy who had been so instrumental in this franchise's turnaround. You know, first of all, helping Toronto win a Grey Cup over Winnipeg in 2022, and then, you know, still having some success in a different role with the Argos last year. So closure for both sides, I guess, but, you know, kind of a nice way for him to wrap up his career.
Now, the documentary called Running Back Relentless will premiere downtown at the Met Entertainment Center April 27th, here is Andrew Harris talking about what to expect in that film and part of the reason he wanted it made.
Well, understanding my story and being able to be honest and open with some of the struggles and successes and just tell my story. And the big thing for me is, everyone sees the show and the things I did on the field. But, you know, there's a lot of things that went on behind the scenes that I kind of struggled with while still performing at a high level. And even not performing at a high level because of these things. And my big message here is to make sure that, you know, if I can influence one person from this film and open some eyes to getting someone over that hill or under that rock and out of that darkness that I was in, you know, it's a win for me.
So Andrew bringing us behind the scenes about some of the things that he was dealing with, Ed, really since he was young. But in this context, from the point in his career when he was suspended for testing positive for a performance-enhancing substance, what should have been a time of celebration turned into something else for Harris.
Yeah, you know, he's really raw in this documentary. I got to see kind of a rough cut of it, Brett, and he's very, very open about his frustrations with his father and his stepfather, his mom too, and some of the things that led to him playing the way he did. You know, he always talked about having this chip on his shoulder, and we knew about his upbringing and this kind of the struggles he had to overcome. But when you see this documentary, there's so many more layers to it. And as you mentioned, there was the PED thing, which he still maintains his innocence on. But I think all that stuff drove him. And as he said in that clip, there was so much more behind the scenes. We got a little taste of it, but when you see the documentary, you'll see how much more he was wearing that every day and how it got him to some dark places sometimes. And so when you think of that as part of the big picture, it makes you appreciate even more what he did on the field, because he was able to kind of channel his frustrations and his anger so successfully on the field and overcome an awful lot of things.
Let's play one more clip here, Ed. And we've touched on this, the fact that Andrew left the Blue Bombers following their Grey Cup championship in 2021. Although ultimately a successful season for the team, it was sort of the beginning of the end for Harris and his playing time for his hometown team.
I pushed a lot of people away from me just by my actions, by my emotions, and just trying to isolate myself because I didn't trust anyone. I didn't know, you know, who was there for me for real, or if it was because of, you know, what I just accomplished on the field. And I really got into this weird, dark place. We get through COVID and the season's canceled, and then we get back to 21, and that's kind of what I'm going through, my personal stuff still. And, you know, I come to the season hurt, and, you know, that's when it starts getting really mucky with the Bombers, and you know, especially with O'Shea, you know, a guy that would, you know, would come over and, you know, have a beer with me. And, you know, we had a personal relationship that we built up over those 4 or 5 years. So, it was tough.
Do you think that helps clear up things, make it a little bit clearer for the reasons behind Andrew's departure, Ed?
Yeah, I think so. And there's more to it there, too. You know, basically what happened is, as he said, he was hurt in 2021, trying to overcome an awful lot of things. And, you know, again, he's given the time to have a different perspective on things. He has a better appreciation for what Kyle Walters and Coach O'Shea did in their decision. And that was basically, he had kind of lost the trust himself of some of the people in that building, and that they wanted to know how committed he was for 2022. And, you know, so that was a real tough decision for the organization. But again, I think everybody's kind of cool with it now, and especially Andrew, and he just seems so content. And that's one of the things that came out in our podcast too, is that for a guy that's had so many struggles, it was, you know, he does seem to be in a good place right now, and to be so open about talking about all these things is really important for him. But for as he said, anybody that he might be able to influence if they watch this documentary.
Andrew Harris, a shoe-in to be a member of that Ring of Honor at some point, Ed?
I would think so. Bob Irving who are part of the committee that picks the people that go up on the Ring of Honor. I mean, how can you not consider a guy that had such an impact like that? There's some legends up there on that Ring of Honor. And I think that I don't think it would surprise anybody that one day down the road, number 33 will be up there too.
Getting excited for May?
Yeah, you know, I was looking at the schedule. The draft is April 30th, and rookie camp's May 8th. That's not too far away. I can actually use my hands almost to count the days, so I'm pretty excited about it.
Ed, we always appreciate you making time, as these are sort of the last couple weeks of your off-season, and I'll put off-season in quotation marks, and we look forward to really ramping up the conversations around the 2024 team in the next few weeks. Thanks, friend.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on, guys, and have a good day.
All right, Ed Tate joining us from BlueBombers.com. Once again, the co-host of the Handled Internally podcast alongside Darren Cameron. So yeah, Bombers just around the corner. It's an exciting time really to be a Winnipeg sports fan. You got the Jets approaching the playoffs, or as I like to call them, the North American Ice Hockey League Championships. I know it's the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yes, 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 yes. You don't need a text message. And I see the hat you're wearing this morning.
Yes.
We're anticipating a big announcement, what are they calling it? An event announcement from the Sea Bears today, Brett?
That's right. The Canadian Elite Basketball League and the Winnipeg Sea Bears, in collaboration with the province and city, will be hosting a special media event to make a major announcement. That's this morning at 10:30 at Canada Life Center. So we think we know. We're not going to say.
We have an inkling.
We think we know what's happening, but this should be... I think this is going to be a good one. And their home opener, I think, is May 24th.
I'll take your word for it. I don't have that committed to memory. Neither I should, but I don't.
I should, too, because I'm going to the game. So I got to get that date right. It's late May. How's that? There we go. So we're asking you this morning about your camping adventures, good or bad. with camping reservations having begun this morning for Birdsill, Winnipeg Beach, and Grand Beach. And my understanding is that it sounds like it's going pretty well. Buddy, who maps his whole summer around his camping, says the last couple of years have been great at ManitobaParks.com. He was able to get a couple of week-long stints at Grand Beach, another few days at Winnipeg Beach. Says it was easy peasy, but we're asking you about your adventures.
That's really good to hear, because there's nothing more frustrating than wanting to do something like this that's not only good for the economy, good for your well-being and everything, and good family time, and then you're not able to do it. And then maybe you're forced to look elsewhere. I know a lot of people love to go to Northwestern Ontario, and it's just, I like going there too, but I only want to go there if I have to. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So it's good to know. 204-780-6868. Is it going as well as it seems, at least from the feedback we're getting?
On the camping story front, Cheryl says, my girlfriend and I went camping at Spruce Woods when we were 16. We get to setting up. My friend sets the truck keys on the picnic table. Well, I guess crows like shiny things.
No.
Cheryl says crows like shiny things. So, oops, there go the truck keys. No spare. So we had some guy friends there who showed us how to hotwire the truck.
Sounds like solid, upstanding citizens.
Needless to say, her dad never let us take the truck again.
Okay. Brett, do you think this is a circumstance where the crow story has been told so many times that Cheryl actually believes it happened, or that the crows actually stole the keys?
I think the crows took the keys.
You do?
Well, to have to go to that extreme measure to learn how to hotwire the truck.
Yes.
Clearly, there was no other choice. The crow absconded with the keys.
Keys get lost for a variety of different reasons.
Are you saying Cheryl is lying?
Nope. I'm not. I'm just asking whether or not Cheryl has... What does Costanza say? It's not a lie if you believe it.
Okay.
And as a father, I would have a hard time. Tell me the story again, and then I think I would sequester each and every person that was involved and have them tell me the story again.
All right.
Crows stealing keys. I think it's a good way to go. That's all I'm going to say.
The mistrust of being a father. Dave says we had quite an experience back in 1980. We were at Birds Hill in the overflow, and we're sitting around the fire having a great time, and we noticed my brother was gone. So we start looking for him. Nobody can find him. We even had to get the park rangers to help. Well, about an hour later, we could hear him stirring.
Oh, boy.
Getting sick. He'd passed out on the backside of his car, and we just couldn't see him. He was there the whole time. Just couldn't find him because he had, I guess he had a bit too much fun, perhaps. Looking to follow up. Did he have too much fun that night, or was he, like, did he fall ill?
And that overflow, you know, quite often in the regular camping, you'll have the odd light around in the overflow. It's pretty dark.
Is it really?
Yeah, well, because you don't necessarily have all the same hookups and power and all that sort of stuff. So the extra light around, it would probably be pretty easy to disappear in the dark there.
Would that be more fun? Like that could overflow be. Area?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a party time too, because there's no trees in between you. It's basically a big field. Let's have some party time.
So keep those camping stories coming. We're going to pick our winners at 9:15. We've got tickets to give away for Lighthouse. They're coming to Club Region Event Center on August 14th. It is Mackling and McGarry. In our next segment, we give away tickets either for Lighthouse or dinner and a movie at the Met to see Titanic on April 14th. We're asking you about your camping stories, good or bad, because of reservations which have begun today for Birds Hill, Winnipeg Beach, and Grand Beach, White Shell tomorrow. And an example of one of the stories we're getting here comes from Darren, who says we are camping in Ontario. We stopped in at Blue Lake. Another vote for Blue Lake. That's three this morning. Set up the campsite. Cooked dinner, sat down for an exciting game of Yahtzee. So I hear this loud thump kind of sound. I look around like, what was that? And then I hear the buzzing and scratching on the inside of my ear and let out a yell that froze everyone around us. A fly had flown in too and got stuck in my ear, and it hurt like heck.
Oof.
I ended up in the emergency of Dryden, Long story short, I ended up coming back to Winnipeg to have a then dead fly plucked from my ear.
Oh, that doesn't sound like a ton of fun.
No, and that sound must be horrifying.
I think my mom used to tell the story about getting a moth in her ear.
Oh, boy.
And having to go to the doctor to get it removed. I'd love to ask her about that, but of course she's not around. But I think that's one of those stories from family lore. One of our loyal listeners, Bob, says, hey, guys, don't forget there are a ton of private campground options.
Mm-hmm.
So keep those in mind if you're getting frustrated and you're not able to find the provincial campground that suits your style, your need. There are plenty of private options out there as well, not only in Manitoba, obviously right across the country. So that's a good reminder. Thanks for that, Bob.
And of course, as well, one of the other things that's getting people excited about spring summer adventures is golf. As Sarah's been telling you in Global News, the city courses, Kildonan, Windsor, and Crescent Park, they all open, Crescent Drive, they all open on Friday. So you can start booking for tee times for that as of just a few moments ago. And the city courses are open. Shooters was open as of yesterday. Southside opens this afternoon, and that's just south of Winnipeg off of Highway 59. It's a great little course. I played it a few times last year towards the end of the season, and they've done remarkable work at improving that course over the last 10 to 15 years, because the first time I played it, it was all right. It was a good design, but it wasn't in the best shape. And now, like, it was one of the, I can't believe how good it is. Fun little course. And it that actually ties into one of the things you often talk about, Greg, is the time commitment to play a full round of golf. 18 holes can be prohibitive for a lot of people.
Yeah, depending on where you live and where you're golfing.
Mm-hmm.
Could be an hour and a half drive. Even if it's fairly close, we'll call an hour and a half your round trip.
Yeah.
And then you want to hit a bucket of balls before you hit the course. You want to hit the driving range. And then, of course, you know, you might have a bite to eat and a beverage afterwards. It can turn into a 6-7 hour day very easily.
Yeah.
And not everyone has that kind of time. So when you can find a course where you can cut that down a little bit, the one course where my bro and I like to play, and you and I have played it, is the Players Course out on Inkster.
Mm-hmm.
Great little 9-hole track. I'm surprised there aren't more 9-hole tracks around, but that's a conversation for another day. But it's just the perfect spot, you know, not too far to drive. It's basically now turns into a 2.5 hour commitment all in.
Mm-hmm.
I can get into that.
Although I went to Players. Maybe it was the day I was with you.
And you forgot to pay the drink tab?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because their debit machine wasn't working.
Correct.
So she said, okay, well, I'll meet you. I'll see you in the clubhouse when you're done.
After you're out.
So I just left. And then I get a phone call from Kelly Moore, who says that this cart server was calling the radio station because we identified ourselves as from CJOB, I guess. So, like, I had made it almost home. And I had to turn around and drive back to the Players Course during rush hour.
You mean Kelly didn't pick up the tab on your behalf? Come on, Kelly. There was an easier way to do this.
So, yeah, I stretched that day out into a long day. But Southside's, they call it an executive course, so it's a little bit shorter. 3.5 hours is a long day there. So you can get 18 holes in there, no problem, in 3 hours and have a good time. And then Oakwood is the other course that I know for sure that's set to open this weekend, starting on Saturday. They're out in St. Anne, just off of Highway 1. There used to be the two courses there. There was Oakwood.
Cottonwood?
And then Cottonwood, yeah.
What happened to Cottonwood? Like, that, I enjoyed golfing there. I mean, the trees, obviously, based on the name alone, should have set you up for the idea, yeah, you're golfing in a bunch of trees. Always lost a ton of golf balls there. But I loved golfing there.
Well, and they had 27 holes too, so you could,
gee whiz,
you could pick which nines you wanted to do. Yeah, I think that shut down, I want to say, almost 10 years ago.
That's really unfortunate.
I think they were talking about developing it for condos or something.
Okay.
But yeah, it's too bad when you see, like, they closed Meadows many years ago, the Meadows at East St. Paul.
Yeah, that was supposed to be developed as well. Nothing really happening on that property. I pass there at least a couple times a week absolutely no sign of anything going on. Falcon Lake was at the Home and Garden Show on Sunday, and there's a new hotel, or the Falcon Lake Hotel has been redone out there. Looks pretty spectacular.
Cool.
So if you're looking for kind of a double whammy excuse to go and spend a couple of days out in Falcon Lake, it looks as though there's, plenty of reasons to go to that part of the province. But if you're looking for an excuse to stay overnight, and then maybe that can be home base. How far is it from Falcon Lake up to, say, Granite Hills, Brett?
Oh, boy. Off the top of my head, it's not exactly a short drive. I think it's a bit of a hike.
From Falcon to Granite?
Yeah.
So that's not necessarily the best home base. Would Pinawa be a better home base and then do Pinawa and then Granite Hills maybe?
Yeah, I know some friends who have done that before. They've gone up and played Granite Hills and then stayed in Pinawa and then played Pinawa on their second day before they made their way home. I mean, it could be done, but I think it's over an hour from Falcon to Granite.
That's a little bit of a hike.
Yeah, but golf, it's here. I'm excited.
You're excited. You're happy. Looking at the long-term forecast, at least on my iPhone here, it's all double-digit highs.
So we're talking camping this morning. Your camping stories with a reservation starting today for Birds Hill, Winnipeg Beach, and Grand Beach, White Shell tomorrow. And one of our runners up here, Kathy and the Raccoons. We were camping at Grand Beach after a bonfire just before bed. The kids took the garbage to the bins. I was in our camper putting things away, and I could hear some rustling noise, figuring it was the kids playing around. So I opened the door to scare them, only to see a family of raccoons gathering our marshmallows, a box of Graham wafers with chocolate bars. Raccoons wanted some s'mores, I guess, and our loaf of bread and potato chips. And I asked, did they abscond with the food? And Kathy says, we only found remnants of the chocolate bar wrappers, bread bag, and Graham wafers box. And then we encountered raccoons at Turtle River Park the following year, but they were kind enough to leave my Tupperware containers not too far from our campsite. And the forensics could not determine from the scratch marks embedded in the plastic which raccoon family.
Have you watched the trades yet?
No. That's starring Ricky from Trailer Park Boys, right?
Correct. And he has a pet raccoon. And he gets raccoon. It just hangs out on his back deck.
Yeah.
Sort of an extra character in the program. So raccoons are absolutely adorable, but they still are trash pandas after all.
Our runner-up today, Greg, is Cheryl.
Yes, it's a peace offering of sorts.
So go ahead with Cheryl's story.
My girlfriend and I went camping at Spruce Woods when we were 16. Get to setting up, and my friend set the truck keys on the picnic table. Well, crows apparently like shiny things. Oops, there go the truck keys. We had no spare. We had some guy friends there who showed us how to hotwire the truck. Needless to say, her dad never let us take the truck again. So, Cheryl, this is probably a true story, but I'm still suspicious. But this is a peace offering. So you're our runner-up today.
So Carol is our winner. Carol says the year was 1979. My boyfriend, now husband, introduced me to camping, water skiing, and horseback riding all in one weekend. So off we go to Falcon Lake, ending up in the overflow site. This is pre-reservation days, pitching our heavy canvas tent in the deep grass. Sitting around the campfire that evening, I put my feet against the metal fire pit and promptly melted my sister's borrowed runners. All right. The next day, I tried water skiing, and let's just say I learned about the famed Falcon Lake enema firsthand. Have you ever heard of this phenomenon, Greg?
I've experienced it. I didn't know that's what it was called, and it was in Lake of the Woods.
Yeah?
Yes. When you fall at high speed when you're trying to get up, or if you successfully got up on water skis or water ski, yeah, that's accurate. Or if you've done a little boat jumping in your day, yeah, that paints the picture.
And Carol goes on to say, undeterred, I was game for trying the horseback riding. As we rode along the trail, no one heeded my concerns that it felt like my saddle was slowly slipping sideways until I eventually landed, saddle and all, on the ground beside the patient horse.
Oh, my goodness.
But still, it was a great weekend, and it never stopped me from camping again, leading me to further camping adventures.
That's all one weekend.
Yep. One weekend.
I would never left the city again.
Carol, congratulations. You get to pick between either Lighthouse coming to Winnipeg on August 14th. Presale tomorrow, by the way, is Sunny. Or dinner and movie at the Met for Titanic on April 14th. Jim Toth is going to be speaking with Andrew Harris.
That's right. We played part of an interview that Andrew did with the Handled Internally podcast hosted by Darren Cameron and Ed Tate talking about the new documentary that's coming out April 27th. In that interview, Andrew announced the fact that he would be signing with the Blue Bombers for one day. And so it's great to know that Andrew's going to join Jim Toth this afternoon just to expand on what we heard in just a very small portion of what was about a 20-minute interview with Darren and Ed. So looking forward to that. I know a lot of Blue Bomber fans will be as well.
That's coming up just at 2 o'clock on 680 CJOB. But last week, a proposed mixed-use development on Sherbrooke Street in Winnipeg's West Broadway neighborhood was made public as the project moved through the city's approval process.
Now, this from the latest column of our next guest in the Free Press. The planned development would replace four older homes with a seven-story apartment building. The project would provide new homes for as many as 150 people, welcoming them to a neighborhood well served by public transit and bike infrastructure with walkable access to local shops, groceries, parks, and schools. Urbanist, architect, Winnipeg booster extraordinaire, Brent Bellamy joins us now. Good morning, Brent.
Good morning.
This project sounds like exactly something we need about 100 more of. When do they start building it?
You know, we definitely do. And that was kind of the point of my column, is that we need all kinds of housing and more and more, as much as we can possibly build. We need all types. And it was really criticized because it isn't what most people would say affordable housing. It does have an affordable component, but not really deeply affordable, not social housing, not rent geared to income housing. And there was a real criticism that it's not being built for the people that live in the neighborhood. And my contention is that we need all types of housing, and that even market rate housing, what's called market rate, what most people would not consider affordable housing, has a really important role to play in keeping rents affordable across the city and sort of regulating the rental market, regulating the housing market in general. It's really important, and it comes down to supply and demand. The reason housing has become so expensive in Canada and in Winnipeg is because we have so much more demand than we do supply. There's way more people need housing than housing we have. We all know that. If there's 50 people that need a home and there's only 10 homes, those 10 homes are going to be really expensive. If there's 75 homes, the 25 landlords that don't have people to live in them are going to drop their rents to try to get you to live in their home.
We've seen that with strip malls. And commercial spaces in Winnipeg for years, it was very stagnant in terms of the appearance of these things. And over the last, since pre-pandemic, every single strip mall in Winnipeg has had an update of some sort. And I can only imagine that's because of the competitive nature of that class of real estate.
You even see it in the single family housing market. We all know there's buyer's markets and seller's markets, and it depends on how many houses there are up for sale at the time. So it's something that happens all the time. You know, the CMHC has said that we need to build 3.5 million more homes in Canada than we're going to build anyways by 2030. 3.5 million, that's 170,000 in Manitoba alone, just to sort of stabilize the market between supply and demand. We're not going to be able to do that.
It's like 30 years worth of housing.
Yeah, we won't be able to do it, but that's the goal, is to build as much as we can. So when I see criticisms of market rent housing, even though it's not specifically affordable today, I sort of push back, because we need as much housing as possible, and we need even market rent housing. We need as much of it as we can get.
So how do we get over this idea then that market rents are a bad thing?
We need to think about the bigger picture. We need to understand that, you know, another important reason why market rate housing is a good thing is because it sort of opens up affordable housing down the housing ladder. So what happens is when a new housing project is built and somebody moves in, so whether you're, you know, you've got a new job or you've become a two-income household, you can afford that higher rent, you're moving into it. Studies have shown that 50% of that time, those people are vacating housing that's more affordable, older buildings. We all see that older buildings are more affordable. most affordable housing in Canada started out as market housing and has just aged to become affordable housing. After 20 years, a building typically loses about 2% of its value every year. So after 20 years, it becomes affordable to somebody with half the income of a new building. So we have to think about it in the big picture. And so what happens is, if we don't build that new market housing, people aren't moving up the ladder, which isn't opening affordable housing down the line. And we saw this in the automobile sector over COVID. In the computer chip issue, they stopped building really expensive new cars. The average price of a new car is $50,000. The average new car buyer is 50 years old. No one would say new cars are affordable. But what we do is we slot into the market on used cars, depending on what we can afford. What happened during COVID was they stopped building new cars, expensive new cars. People who would typically buy those cars hung on to their old cars longer, didn't move their older cars into the market, and there became more demand for good used cars. What happened? The used car market spiked during COVID. And the exact same thing happens with housing.
So I hear what you're saying, and I even endorse it somewhat, but I'm gonna play the counter narrative here. So I'm not a fan of trickle down economics and the idea of selling me on trickle down economics and the benefit of giving the top corporations a tax break because they're going to pay me more money eventually. I think we've decided that yep, doesn't necessarily absolutely translate. Yep. I don't think the answer to the housing crisis in Canada is more 800, 900, 1,000, $1 million houses in the GTA. I don't think that's helping yep anybody ultimately. So why is that different? Why is what you're talking about different than, well, if we build a bunch of McMansions in Toronto, that's going to cascade down. Eventually people will have a place to live.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I don't like, it's easy to sort of shut down the argument by saying trickle-down economics is the same as trickle-down housing. They're completely different things. There's a finite amount of housing that people need to live in, and we need to increase that. It's more equating supply and demand with trickle-down economics. They're completely different things. And, you know, I really want to stress that this is just a part of the puzzle. We definitely need market-rate housing as much as we can build. We also need as much as we can build purpose-built affordable housing. We need social housing. We need rent geared to income. We need housing to address homelessness. We need as much of that as possible, but we can't push that onto private developers. They simply can't afford to do it. The economics of development don't work with supportive and, you know, affordable housing out of the box. It needs to be pushed by the government. And so when I see people criticizing developers for not building affordable housing or supportive housing or rent geared to income housing, we can't do that unless we collectively decide that's our priority and through government push that as much as we can. And I'm a 100% strong advocate that we need to be building that as much as possible, even more than market rate housing. We can't disregard market rate housing, but we need to have both.
Yeah. And I think, is that where we're at right now societally? It always seems to be a one or the other.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, like either we're fixing every single pothole in Winnipeg before we build public infrastructure, yeah, whether it be cycling or transit infrastructure. There doesn't seem to be a conversation about what we can do, both rapid transit or extending Chief Peguis Trail and Route 90. Yeah. I know that's a broader conversation, but in terms of being able to walk and chew gum at the same time, we seem to be having a real difficult time doing those things.
The housing crisis is a really complex thing that needs really complex solutions, and it means different things to different people. For some people, it means not being able to buy a single family home, you know, that our parents used to be able to do affordably. That's a different housing crisis to some people. To some people, it's homelessness. To some people, it's, you know, rental rates. It's a really complex web, but it takes every kind of housing to solve that problem. And so when I see people criticizing one type of housing because they believe we should only build another type, I push back because we need all of it.
And it seems like such an endorsement for that part of the city. I mean,
yeah, no question.
You and I are the same vintage.
Yeah, no question.
I mean, Sherbrooke, Maryland, let's face it, it's had such a renaissance over the last decade. Could you credit the people that live there now? Yeah, absolutely. But I think also it's the people that go there from other parts of the city that spend their money there. Why wouldn't you want people, well-heeled people, to contribute to the mix and to the economy and to maybe even create more in that neighborhood, unless that's a bad thing also.
It brings investment to that neighborhood. And that building specifically has seven retail units at the base along the sidewalk. So it's bringing seven new shops to the neighborhood. Those could be locally owned businesses. They typically are. You know, they're providing employment for locally owned, for local residents in the community. That's really important. It creates that walkable neighborhood that so people don't have to own cars. It makes the neighborhood more affordable to live in because, you know, those 150 people that live there, their kids can walk to school instead of driving them. They, you know, they can maybe have one less car or no car even, which really increases affordability. And it's really about, yeah, elevating the entire neighborhood by introducing good investment and bringing 150 new homes. We forget when we get angry at multifamily buildings, those are homes for people. 150 people get to live in this neighborhood, and it's going to, you know, bring traffic to the street, and it's going to bring eyes to the street to increase safety. There's really no downfall. Not to say that we also shouldn't build affordable housing. We need to do that too.
I'm just curious, as a resident of Osborne Village, in the sense of one of the things I've wondered about, I'm just basing this on my own observation, but that neighborhood is quieter than it was, say, 20 years ago. When I went to Red River College, mm-hmm. half of my classmates lived in Osborne Village because they could afford it.
Yeah.
And now every time they put up a new building, the rent is like $1,400 minimum. And the street's a lot quieter because it's probably people, you know, who are maybe a bit older, like me, who I get home from work and I just sit on my couch. I don't go out. I rarely go out and to the local restaurants or whatever that are right down the street from me, unless I'm going to the store to buy, you know, a loaf of bread or something. So I'm just wondering, like, by adding all of this housing that is great, but could be maybe too expensive for a certain segment of the population. Yeah. Can that hurt a neighborhood?
Yeah. Osborne Village is a really interesting case, and I'm going to write a column about it one day. I'm just thinking about how to do that. Our memory of it is that it was this sort of grungy, vibrant place. It was that because all those houses that everyone lived in were derelict houses, and the buildings that we lived in were derelict. You know, they were well below market rent houses because they were old and worn out, and the neighborhood is going through a rejuvenation, and it is gentrification. That's the difficult challenge in the whole thing, is that we need to be able, that's why we need to build all kinds of housing, because when you introduce higher rent housing, it does bring a different type of, you know, then suddenly the shops become a fancier coffee shop instead of an old record store because there's a different market that is being introduced. But it's a transition in a neighborhood, and Osborne Village is going through a transition. When it comes out the other side, it will be a different thing than it was when we were kids. But we have to make sure that there is place for everybody in that type of neighborhood. And it's a very delicate balance, and gentrification is a real thing. Winnipeg hasn't had to face it very much because we don't have huge amounts of development in our inner city. Osborne Village is really the first neighborhood to go through that. And we're seeing there's two big developments happening right on Osborne that are going to introduce, you know, 600 new people to the neighborhood, to that street. And it's going to change the vibe of that street. But it's just a thing we need to manage. When we build these kinds of things, we need to really think about things like, you know, rental rights, renter's rights, and, you know, capping rent protection and those kinds of things to make sure that older housing stock doesn't get demolished. It's just something we need to really consider because gentrification is an important thing. We just need to manage it. It's a trick.
You can read more in the Free Press. Brent Bellamy, always a pleasure to talk to you. We've run out of time. We could talk to you for another hour and a half. So thank you so much for coming in. Great to see you.
Great to join you up in the Eagle's Nest. I love it.